In nothing have the habits of the palate more decisive influence than our relish of wines. Thomas Jefferson. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank everyone for joining me this week. I hope you will enjoy the episode, and if you are a newcomer, welcome. Please feel free to peruse our backlog of episodes, and if you're a returning listener, again, thank you so much. It really means a lot. I was happy to see that the downloads stayed pretty consistent when the new episode came out after a couple weeks off, so it made me very happy that it seemed like people were looking forward to it. even though, of course, last week's episode wasn't too heavy on the history. There were some history facts, but it was, of course, mostly etymology and kind of geography. This week, we're diving back in a little bit more traditional historical stuff, where we'll be talking about the emerging material culture of the Southern Caucasus, plus a little bit of Northwest Iran, or what is now modern Northwest Iran, between the years of 6 and 4000 BC, BCE, whichever you prefer, their potential origins, and links to other peoples who may or may not have already been talked about. First, it's important to remember that the Caucasus have a very long history of humans traveling through and living in the area, and this includes our predecessors and cousin species like Homo erectus, Neanderthals, and Denisovans. And there's at least some evidence of Homo sapiens living there since at least around 30,000 years ago, and probably earlier. That said, the area wasn't the most populated region. I imagine being close to the mountains during the winters wasn't particularly fun, but those temperatures may have led to an important step of humanity's use of textiles. I mentioned it in the past seasons, talking about the region, but there is evidence of humans harvesting wild flax and possibly dyeing it right around 30,000 years ago, perhaps in an effort to prepare more layers of clothing before winter and snowy seasons, or to migrate north into the Eurasian steppe. Though I shouldn't make it out to be that bad of a place. There would be a lot of good stone and wild plants in the areas, not to mention lots of wild ungulates, I guess. And starting between sometime between 16,000 and 13,000 years ago, a small but steady number of humans began to inhabit the area permanently or semi-permanently, at least. And this is known as the Triolatia Mesolithic. Now, there is another Triolatia culture that will come up, I think next season, but they're different. This culture appears to have been relatively small population-wise, though there is evidence that they were interacting with all of their neighbors fairly regularly. Of course, some more than others. They had contact with the, or they probably had contact with the Tas Tepler sites in eastern Anatolia. Some peoples north of the Caucasus, of course. Though by far, their neighbors in what is now the, again, the northwestern portion of Iran and along the Caspian Sea coast, the southern Caspian Sea coast, were their closest partners. And we know this based on the amount of shared or similar cultural artifacts and based on DNA. Now, again, we do show that there is admixture of a little bit of Caucasian hunter-gatherers into the Tas Tepler population. But again, there was more shared ancestry to those living all along the Iranian plateau and the southern Caspian coast. So basically, a lot of sites within the Caspian Sea region and the Zagros Mountains. These were all very, or fairly closely related, I guess, cousin populations, you call them. So there's kind of like a little triangle between the Southern Caucasus, the Caspian Sea region, and the Zagros Mountains. And these ties were not just, oh, they broke off from each other. No, these ties continued regularly. There was a lot of back marriage and, you know, that kind of thing. Pretty much throughout the like early Neolithic period, even if those groups weren't necessarily themselves within the Neolithic kind of tool assemblage at that point. Now, as I mentioned, its formation dates of the Tree of Latia are debated, but its material artifacts begin to decline and then disappear right around the start of this season. So right around 6000 BC, give or take a couple hundred years, probably towards the start. Why this happened is debated, and there are a couple of theories. Some think that contact with the rapidly changing and expanding cultures in Mesopotamia and Anatolia had introduced new concepts and tools from the Neolithic Revolution, and exploration and adoption of these new apparati broke down old communal and cultural ties, leading to the Tree of Latia breaking into smaller groups, trying to figure out the best way to use these new ideas. Another theory is that the resources the Tree of Latia relied on became harder to access, and prestige items gained through trade with those sites that we talked about dried up. Now, of course, neither of these theories are incompatible with each other, and there is evidence for both. So it's possible that it's kind of a mix of both of these things. In fact, I would say it would be probable for both of these things to happen. Now, the question then becomes, of course, which was the more important factor? Well, that's a little bit harder to answer. But, you know, going over what comes next might help us form an opinion on that. But again, regardless of the reason, this decline in the Tree of Latia came at a very convenient time for a new group. And this is the material culture known as the Shulaveri-Shomu culture. And it runs between about 6000 and 5000 BC. Now, the peoples belonging to this culture are the ones to introduce agriculture, and they expand herding in the region and begin the pottery Neolithic in this part of the world. Now, the name Shulaveri-Shomu comes from the initial sites belonging to the culture, or at least their modern sites. These were Shomu Tepe, Tojra Tepe, and Baba Dervish. And these were discovered by the Soviet Azerbaijan archaeologist Narimanov Idil Hamidoglu in 1958. Now, these sites were located in what is now Western Azerbaijan, and he would lead excavations at these sites and others, smaller ones, until 1964. A couple years after that, in 1966, more sites in Soviet Georgia and Armenia were discovered by A.I. I'm going to butcher this, apologies to any Kartvelian speakers. A.I. Dajavashvili and T.N. Chubinishvili. And there were other sites later discovered in what is now, again, northwestern Iran. Now, I could not find anything in English about the first or the two Georgian names I mentioned, aside from them being cited in other papers and being credited with the discovery of Shulaveri and other sites in Georgia and Armenia. From their names, I'm going to assume that they are Georgian, possibly Armenian. I know the modern town of Shulaveri has a sizable Armenian minority, and it is right on the Armenian-Georgian border. In fact, the name Shulaveri is what the town was known as until the 1920s. After that, it was renamed to Shalmiani, after an Armenian Bolshevik revolutionary, Stepan Shalmian. Why they chose to use the older name for the type site designation, I couldn't find out. I read, but no one even brought it up. I also couldn't get a firm etymological breakdown of either name, but Shalmian may have meant something like little profit, and that is profit as in monetary gain, not as in a religious, a religious figure. Now, Shulaveri is probably related to the old Armenian word shukua, or shuk'a, which is a loan word from classic Syriac, and it could have meant something like a narrow street or narrow market. So, just the site, the old Shulaveri was probably some type of small market town. Now, As for Shomu Tepe, I could not find any etymology for this site. Excuse me. Obviously, we know what Tepe means, but Shomu is a mystery to me. Other languages have similar words, but none of the primary languages of the Caucasus have the word. So it might have come from a Russian word like Shoma, which can mean like, it can mean a lot of different things, but it can mean like cluttered or loud or noisy. But honestly, I have no idea. So if anyone knows what that might mean in any of the Caucasian languages, I would be very interested to know. Now, the Shulaviri Shomu culture, or as I'm going to keep abbreviating it from now on to save us all some time and save our ears as well, we're going to call it the SSC. Now, this was again made up by groups migrating from outside the region, most likely from northern Mesopotamia or southeastern Anatolia, meaning that based on the time frame, these peoples were probably related to either the Hassuna or Halaf cultures, or they were offshoots of the immediate predecessors of the Hassuna or Halaf peoples. And we know this because DNA found that the SSC sites show almost no overlap with the preceding Caucasian hunter-gatherer populations. Now, I will say that this does change eventually, and later populations and material cultures will have some background from both sets of DNA. There will be, you know, they might have more CHG, they might have more SSC, but you will begin to see these two ancestries come together at some point. But that doesn't happen until after the SSC ends, and we'll get into that in a little bit more detail later. And we can also tell that they came from outside the Caucasus by the sheer amount of seeds and domesticated herd animals they brought with them into the region. Things that were not there in any way close to the numbers and may not have been there at all prior to the arrival of the SSC. They bring in over a dozen varieties of wheat and barley, not to mention a handful of different types of lentils and peas. And these people will also be the first to make grape wine and fully domesticate the grapes that the preceding hunter-gatherer populations of the regions had been harvesting, and probably, again, were kind of doing that soft horticulture, you know, picking out the best spots and grapes and bushes and that kind of thing. But they had a little bit more direct knowledge of how to develop crops, of course, at that point. And they do this very quickly. Within 200 years after the start of the SSC, several of their sites have kind of proto-wineries and vineyards that we talked about in one of our domestication episodes at the start of this season. But before we get too much further into this, I do need to kind of pull back just a little, because I'm making it sound like this was a big planned migration by a group of people. That's not quite the case. There is an influx of migrants from outside of this region, from, again, somewhere in northern Mesopotamia and or southeastern Anatolia. But there are small regional variations between all of between the sites. The SSC is actually probably an amalgamation of around three or so larger, or not larger, three or so groups, you know, moving into various parts of the Caucasus, you know, within a couple hundred years of each other. So, like, relatively close, but also not at the same time. So this is something that is happening probably organically, and again, while there is overlap in the material culture, there are enough regional variations that people assume that, you know, they're not one people. They're probably related to each other in some way, or at least have some type of knowledge of, you know, their neighbors when they're moving into the region, but it's not like a one big cultural migration. This is probably a wave of probably 3 to 6 groups moving in, and then some of them forming smaller or combining together to form around 3 settled groups, all inhabiting various archaeological regions. Interestingly enough, though, they are kind of centered into the 3 main countries that make up, you know, the Southern Caucasus, in the modern day. The group kind of in what is now Georgia at Shulaviri, these are the ones that you would find the wine-producing places by and large. Whereas the group towards, I guess, the middle of the Kurva River, the Kura and where the Araxes meet, going towards the Caspian Sea in what is now mostly Azerbaijan, they're another group. And then you got the ones kind of in closer to the Armenia, where they're smaller in terms of population, but they, they're closer to Anatolia and Upper Mesopotamia, so they have a little bit better trade access, at least to Mesopotamia. Obviously, groups further north would have better access to the Eurasian steppe. Now, what they kind of all have in common is their homes. They're almost all, they all are single-story, single-room buildings, either circular or oval. They have hearths in the center. They have a kind of a circular raised hole in the center to allow, of course, the smoke to leave and to allow the sunlight to come in, natural light. Their doors are all extremely narrow. Their villages are almost all around the same size, about 1 hectare, give or take, though there are some that are larger. They could be large as, I think the largest one I read about was 6 hectares, but most of the larger settlements were about 5, or between 4 and 5, I should say. But typically, these larger settlements were surrounded by kind of a ring of smaller villages that, again, were 1 hectare. Some of them were surrounded by trenches. These were probably defensive or possibly to help corral animals, though there are some that think this is for ritual purpose. I don't know if I buy that too much, but make of that what you will. They had separate storage areas. Their storage buildings tend to be smaller than the residential buildings. But again, the residential buildings were all one room. Now, sites tended to, be permanent, but eventually a lot of them, the smaller settlements at least, would be abandoned. And then they would found another village not too far away. Why this is, I'm not sure. I didn't really see it come up too much in the literature. It may be that, they had just exhausted the surrounding soil, and instead of, working out crop rotation, they would just leave the villages. Because, again, there's not too much complexity in these settlements. They're fairly straightforward. And I'm sure it was work, but, you've got the town not far from where your village is. If things start to go bad, you can retreat to the larger settlement, make use of the stored food and supplies there while a new settlement is planned out, or maybe an old one that was abandoned a couple of generations ago is maybe reoccupied. So that's part of the reason why you see these tells build up, especially so quickly in the region, because there's only around 1,000 years or so that this part of the material culture survives. Now, in terms of pottery, they do make their own, but it's very, very rough, at least initially. The pottery is very rudimentary, not very smooth, kind of busted, essentially. But there is, again, evidence of trade with other places making finer pottery. However, after a couple of hundred years, right around 5700 BC, 5600 BC, they've really kind of come to their own, and they're producing their pottery locally. They decorate their pots with a lot of animalistic designs, a little bit of geometric lines, that kind of thing. And eventually they begin to paint and dye them. That's kind of towards the end of the SSC period. Eventually they actually make a very nice red polished pottery. Now, in terms of tools, they, of course, have everything you would expect to find with the Neolithic toolkit. And they're making things from not just stone, but also obsidian, bones, antlers, all that kind of stuff. And obsidian, of course, is a very prestigious, or at least believed to be prestigious material for a lot of tools. They're also creating figurines, mostly female, or at least they appear to be female. A lot of them are seated, so, you know, there's that motif that we've seen in a lot of different Neolithic societies, possibly that mythical singular mother goddess, or, you know, just a collection of different goddesses of either fertility or motherhood. We don't have very many individual burials. There are some that have been found buried beneath floors or kind of the courtyard areas between various homes and storage facilities, but these are very rare and they're almost always individuals. However, we have found another of kind of group tombs or graveyards, kind of with this, I think the largest one has around 50 people, I believe. And then there are some that have smaller. I think there were some that had like, 20 to 30 individuals. And they're all various ages, men and women. But they don't seem to have any kind of social stratification, at least at this period. Now, this is also a region where you will find the SSC, or at least some of the SSC sites are working with copper beads. Now, the dates on this are very highly debated. It's like a 700-year gap. Some say it's as early as 5800. Some say it's as late as 5200. Just keep that in mind. So, but there are, again, copper beads that have been found. These were located in what is now the sites in Georgia. There are some people who say they even have crucibles for kind of heating the copper to help bang it out, though that is debated. There are some sites in Azerbaijan as well that kind of have, you know, again, evidence of copper work too. But this is, some people think that might be a little bit later. But again, this is very rudimentary. It's not true metallurgy yet, at least from what we can tell. They're mostly just kind of finding the copper deposits and then hammering or cold rolling them or, you know, heating them to just enough to make them a little bit more malleable. Not enough to melt them down and, like, form really intricate objects. That happens a little bit later, of course, in this region and other places. Now, kind of in the middle of the two of the groups of the SSC, the ones in Georgia and the ones in Azerbaijan, where the Kura River kind of like right in the middle, where the two groups kind of overlap in agricultural land, there is evidence that they were practicing kind of an early form of irrigation. Now, this is not flood control irrigation that you would see in Mesopotamia. This is more like they just needed the water. So they were trying to actually divert a river to an extent. And they were able to do it. It's a very small river. It's the Shulaveri River. But that doesn't seem to have been too profitable for them. They were able to divert the river, but I guess the detritus and debris that comes with it, it kept kind of drying up and changing course. So they had to keep almost a constant set of work to keep that going. And it appears that they abandoned it after a couple of a couple of generations. But this is the first, again, evidence outside of Mesopotamia and Egypt that, you know, irrigation and is being worked on, though, again, for a very different reason, not to divert floods, but to just provide more water to settlements for either crops or for humans or for animals or all three, as is most likely the case. But after 1,000 years or so of reasonable growth and progress, the SSC begins to not disintegrate, but to we lose trace of it, and to an extent, the archaeological record. Their artifacts become much scarcer. They appear to shrink in terms of geographic region. Now, why this is, isn't exactly known. If you are remembering our discussions about the Halaf and Hassuna cultures, you would know the Hassuna, the Halaf culture, begins to disappear around 100 years prior to the disappearance of the SSC, or at least it becomes much smaller. And, you know, perhaps there's a tie-in there, due to lack of long-distance trade with their distant cousins. This forces a certain amount of economic decline among the SSC. There could also be an additional environmental factor, similar to how the Hassuna and Halaf cultures, who relied on rain and precipitation to grow their crops more than anything else. There is a kind of a dry period for around 1,000 years or so, maybe a little bit longer, both in the Caucasus and eastern Anatolia, northern Mesopotamia, where the rains don't fall as regularly. That also could have had a drastic effect on the SSC. But there are also, again, the Triolatia culture to consider. While they abandoned a lot of their old sites, there is, some evidence, genetic evidence especially, that shows that they weren't gone. It's possible that they had retreated further north into the mountainsides. And that assumption to that, them retreating to that region, is based on a lot of comparisons of modern DNA, specifically of modern Georgians. Along the Black Sea coast and the foothills of the southern Caucasus in Georgia, you'll see that around 60% or so, some a little bit less, some a little bit more, they have over half of their ancestry based in the Caucasian hunter-gatherers. They have, ancestry related to the SSC as well, but it's possible that during this period of decline, people less reliant on agriculture did a little bit better job of surviving. Or maybe they were beginning to move into regions that the or move back into regions that they had had abandoned when the SSC moved in. So you have these two groups probably beginning to interact more regularly with each other, both in terms of conflict and of cooperation, as one might expect. And you begin to see other smaller material cultures arrive. This includes what's known as the Sioni culture. They're famous for mixing in crushed up obsidian into their pottery. That's kind of one of the things they're known for. And they were emerging kind of along what is now Western Georgia. In the east, you have what is known as the Meshoko culture. This is kind of North Azerbaijan, Eastern Georgia, that kind of region. And when I say cultures, they found a couple of sites for each of these, but they're not very widespread. They literally only have two or three locations. But some of their trademarks at these sites do show up later in much wider areas. So there's probably a mixing of some sort during this kind of decline of the SSC, where hunter-gatherer groups, remnants of the Tri-Latina culture, are beginning to experience kind of a comeback, if you will. With the SSC not able to produce as much food, they may have had to rely more on trade with more experienced hunters. Now, the SSC peoples did hunt, but there's not a lot of evidence for, you know, of it at a large scale. They did fish as well, which, you know, that would be useful, especially with the rains drying up. You are right on the Araxes and the Kura rivers, so, you know, they are able to get some of their nutrition that way. But, you know, you have these outsiders who've probably been on the peripheral of your society for a very long time, who are beginning to, you know, be able to provide food to you when the time when you need it. This probably led to some people maybe abandoning the cities and joining the hunter-gatherer groups. Or perhaps the hunter-gatherer groups, sensing the weakness among the SSC sites, took advantage and maybe tried to reoccupy old lands, or, you know, clear them out, maybe take over their herds. That would be a very, you know, viable solution, because that's happened before and it will happen afterwards. So you have a couple of different factors playing in here. And while there's no one big culture that kind of emerges after the SSC, you've got around 1,000 years or so before you begin to see another big-time material culture emerge. And it is right at the end of this season where you see the smaller single-site or semi-regional groups begin to give way to another emerging large-scale culture in the region. And this is known as the Kura-Araxes culture. Or rather, I should say it will be known as the Kura-Araxes culture. Now, this does not fully form during kind of the period of our season. The beginnings of the society, or of the material culture, whatever you want to call it, start around right around 4000 BC. But it will not become firmly established and spread out until a little bit later. This does not mean that the other cultures, the small regional cultures, are going away. Far from it. They're going to remain. They will continue to evolve. They'll enter other phases of their lifestyle. They will at periods be, you know, tied into the economy of, you know, the Kura-Araxes is one, but there are other cultures that are nearby that they'll have contacts with. Urartu, the Gutians, the Hurrians, the Hittites. These peoples do maintain kind of a independent identity within sometimes larger groups or neighboring other groups. And that's something that I think has been established, you know, probably during this period. Sadly, it is a bit of a mystery because, again, just the archaeological evidence, there's a very big gap. There's about 600 or so years between the end of this season and when the Kura-Araxes really begins to emerge and expand. And as you might guess, the name comes from the Kura and the Araxes rivers where they meet. That's kind of going to become the big heartland of the culture and where they will do the best. Though, again, it's not where they emerge. They emerge a little bit further upriver in what is now Armenia. Specifically, it's the Ararat Plain. That is something to discuss next season. We will be moving a little bit further to the south and west to discuss the Zagros inhabitants and the Caspian Sea inhabitants next week. I hope you will join me for that. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. I hope it wasn't too short. I think I got all the highlights I wanted to hit. But if you do have any questions, feedback, constructive criticism, I would be happy to hear it. You can direct message me on X/Twitter. You can send me an email to war@refpod@gmail.com. You can leave a comment on any of the YouTube videos. I will read them. It may take me a little while, especially for older episodes. Sometimes they don't send me notifications on those, so I just happen to be browsing through and looking at stuff, and it'll show up there. And if you are listening on YouTube, please subscribe there and like whatever video you saw. If you are listening on any of the audio-only apps, please rate, subscribe, all that kind of stuff. It will really help the channel grow. I'm hoping that we'll maybe be eligible for some type of monetization. Not that I need the money, but it would be nice to be able to invest some of that back into the show. I would very much like to get a new microphone, maybe some soundproofing a little bit. That would be helpful, but you know, it's not necessary. I'm going to continue the show regardless. I have a lot of fun doing this. I've met a lot of interesting people via, you know, email or people dropping by the live streams on the YouTube channel. It's really a lot of fun. So I do hope that you all will continue to listen. And for those of you who have never reached out and provided feedback or anything like that, please feel free to do so. It really is very gratifying. So, thank you all. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. And I will see everyone next week. I hope you have a good rest of your day/week from whenever you are listening to this. Someone had asked me about the schedule for the holiday coming up. We will not miss an episode, I do not believe, this year. We may miss that last Monday in December. I'm not 100% on that one yet. But there should be an episode out every Monday going forward until that New Year stuff. So anyway, thank you all. Have a good one. Peace.